welcome to Patreon episode number 2 of Queer Crime. I'm your host, Patrick. Wow, my second Patreon episode. As always, thank you for being a patron. You truly won't have any idea how much this means to me, but you really are keeping me motivated to continue researching, writing, recording, and publishing each episode of Queer Crime. It gives me great comfort to know that there are people out there, people like you, who are keen to make sure that these queer crime stories continue to be heard. So you guys are the committed and gorgeous queer crimers around the world who can directly take credit for making sure that these stories don't get lost amongst all of the other noise. All of your donations on Patreon are going to assist with more research, improved recording equipment, and improved software. Everything will be redirected into making sure that I can satisfy your insatiable thirst for these stories committed by shitty people. I will also be looking at additional benefits for my patrons. So if you, as a loyal patron of the show, can think of any benefits that you would like, please let me know, and I will see if I can add them into the mix. I'll move on to the story now, but once again, I want to say thank you. Genuinely, thank you. Advance warning. This episode contains details about sexual violence against a minor, details about sexual assault, details about a violent murder, and descriptions of a killer who is a complete cock. I guarantee that you'll hate him from the outset. It's 2019. Best musical at the Tonys was Hadestown. Outstanding comedy series at the Emmys was Fleabag. Song of the Year at the Grammys was This Is America by Childish Gambino. And Best Picture at the Oscars was Green Book. I have researched, written, recorded, edited, and published over 30 episodes of Queer Crime now. I have read about all sorts of people who are mad, people who are bad, and people who are twats. The guy in this story beats almost all of those people. I hate being unkind about people, but this man deserves all of the vitriol you can muster. A total wanker. A horrible bastard to his very core. Someone with no interest in anything except himself and his own pleasure. An ugly son of a bitch who should be backlit at all times so your eyesight isn't offended. I don't know him, but suffice to say, I hate him. The man that I am referring to is Nathan Maynard Ellis. He was born on the 21st of May 1990 in the West Midlands in England. As a child, he was pretty average in school and wasn't popular, which was compounded by his burgeoning interest in horror movies and gore. But it wasn't just that. Having an interest in horror movies is definitely not a sign that you're odd or that you don't deserve friends. It was Nathan's deep fixation with horror movies and horror movie memorabilia that made him stand apart. It went from an interest to a fascination to an obsession. And it ended up giving him a warped view of the world. Coupled with Nathan's obsession with the horror genre was his growing interest in sexual violence. This grew rapidly, and it started to appear quite quickly during one of his earlier relationships as a teenager. In 2007, when he was 17 years old, Nathan had begun a relationship with a 15-year-old girl. Given her young age, her name has been kept out of the public domain, but information about their relationship became public, as you'll find out later. Due to the girl's family life and economic situation, she was quite vulnerable, and she latched onto Nathan as some form of escapism from her dreadful life. Nathan, however, wasn't her knight in shining armour. He wasn't there to save her. He was in that relationship to control her. In fact, this relationship made this poor young girl even more vulnerable than she was before she met him. Their relationship was violent, and she was controlled entirely by Nathan. Very soon after they met, she became aware that Nathan was fascinated by horror films and serial killers. She also became aware that he had fantasies about killing someone, and, as their relationship became more violent, she feared that it might go too far one day, and she might be his first victim. However, she also suspected that Nathan would prefer to kill someone unknown to him. He often carried a black hood along with a rope and a knife in case he found a woman to sexually assault and strangle. He said to his girlfriend, on numerous occasions, that he often thought about what it would be like to have sex with a corpse. Disclosing this type of information made Nathan vulnerable, though. He knew that declaring that he wanted to kill someone and have sex with their corpse would shift the power dynamic, because it put his girlfriend in a position of power where she could go to the police with this information. He needed to make sure that whatever he said to her about his fantasies, it could go no further. He made sure that she knew that she had to keep her mouth shut, or he would kill her. And he would back up these threats with actual physical violence. These episodes of physical violence towards his young, vulnerable girlfriend grew in frequency and severity. On two separate occasions, he anally raped her and threatened her each time with more violence if she even considered reporting him. On another occasion, in the summer of 2008, he took her to a secluded nature reserve and he raped her again. He said that if she screamed or reported him, he would shoot her with a gun that he had brought with him. And on another occasion, he took her to a secluded area by a canal and he raped her at knife point. His young girlfriend realized that if she tried to resist him or fight him, it actually increased his sexual pleasure, so she started to learn to be submissive. She didn't fight back. She didn't cry out in pain or beg for him to stop. She accepted the violence and sexual assaults, and this infuriated Nathan. His interest in her waned when his sexual pleasures became less fulfilled by her submissiveness. Eventually, thankfully, their relationship ended, and soon afterwards, Nathan came out as gay. Within 2 years, he had started another relationship with a younger guy called David Leasley, who was 5 years younger than him, after they had met online. David actually pretended to be 18 years old, but he was, in fact, only 16 years old. Nathan, at this point, was 21 years old. They moved into a small and grotty flat together in a small town of Tipton, which is about 10 miles northwest of the city of Birmingham. Over the years, Nathan's obsession with horror movies continued, but it had developed into full-blown fantasies about sexual violence, murder, and necrophilia. The small flat that he shared with David was the stuff of nightmares. It had dead stuffed animals on the walls, reptiles in tanks, dolls' heads, knives, and grotesque horror masks on display. The bookcase and DVD case contained books and movies about beheadings and necrophilia. There was no question that David was aware that Nathan was into dark acts of sexual violence. However, throughout his teens and his 20s, Nathan's fantasies had remained just that, fantasies. He told David all about his desires, but he hadn't acted on them. They were able to fulfill each other's sexual desires as much as possible. Then, when Nathan was 30 years old and David was 25 years old, it all changed. One fateful night in May 2019, Nathan acted out his fantasy. On Saturday the 11th of May 2019, Nathan went out for some drinks on his own and left David at home. He went to a pub called The Bottle and Cork in Dudley. Inside the pub, he ordered himself a drink and he sat at the bar. A few moments after arriving, he was approached by a 42-year-old woman called Julia Rawson. Julia had been on a night out with a friend, but by the time she approached Nathan in the pub, she was on her own and she was clearly very drunk. As Nathan had just arrived at the pub, he was sober and was friendly with the drunk woman. Julia flirted with Nathan for a while and wrote her name on a napkin and put it in his pocket. They continued chatting for a few hours, steadily getting more and more drunk. At 2 a.m, Julia and Nathan decided to call it a night. Julia, being a friendly soul who had no desire for her night to end just yet, left the pub with Nathan and agreed to carry on the party back at Nathan's place. They arranged a taxi, and when it arrived, they bundled themselves into the cab for the short journey back to Nathan's flat. When they arrived at the flat, Nathan kept up the charade that he was interested in continuing drinking. By this time, David had joined them too. However, soon after they arrived at the flat, Julia was mercilessly attacked by Nathan and David. She was struck 4 times over the head with a rolling pin as she sat on their couch, which rendered her unconscious, and she died soon afterwards. After they had done what they wanted to do with Julia's dead body, they cut her into 12 parts using a saw. Her arms were cut off, and her hands were separated from her arms. Her legs were cut off, and then they removed her feet. Her head was removed, and her body was cut through at the spine. After they cut up Julia's body and put the pieces into several bags, they cleaned themselves up and went to bed. When they woke up the next morning, Nathan and David took every step they could to conceal Julia's murder. They went to Nathan's mother's house, where they burned the bloodstained clothing in an incinerator bin in the back garden. The next door neighbour watched them burning the clothes and made a note of the date and time that it was taking place, in case they needed that information in the future. Later that day, Nathan went to the pub again and was seen on CCTV, smiling, joking, and chatting with someone on his phone. The following day, they took all of Julia's various body parts, which had been put in carrier bags, and they dumped the bags near a canal and separate locations in wasteland at the rear of a primary school. Again, they were not clever or inconspicuous when carrying out these actions. They were spotted by a member of the public disposing of the carrier bags, and additionally, they had been picked up on CCTV. After they dumped the body parts, they decided to make sure that all of the evidence of the killing had been removed from their flat. They ordered new carpet for their living room and arranged for carpet fitters to come to their flat to lay the new carpet the following day. There was still the issue of the blood-stained couch, though. This needed to be disposed of, but neither of them drove or had a car, so this was going to be much more difficult to get rid of. 4 days after Julia had been killed on the couch by being bludgeoned to death, Nathan asked one of his unsuspecting friends to help him take the couch, as well as the old carpet, to a local rubbish dump. He also asked his friend if they could take a quick detour by a secure storage facility that they had rented, so he could put a rug in there. Again, their friend had no idea that the rug was covered in bloodstains. Perhaps I'm too interested in true crime, but unlike their friend, I would have been incredibly suspicious and asked loads of questions. Or perhaps I'm too cynical. I trust fucking no one these days. After all of these actions, burning their clothes, ordering new carpet, and taking the bloodstained couch and the bloodstained carpet to the rubbish dump, the sickening part is that Nathan and David carried on with their lives, carefree and happy, as if nothing had been going on. Nathan even went out a few days after Julia's murder to celebrate his birthday with David and some friends. However, Julia's disappearance was noted almost immediately. She might have been the life and soul of the party and liked to go out for a drink, but she was not irresponsible. She always kept in touch with her partner and would definitely let them know if she was going to stay over somewhere. Her friends and family were concerned that this fun-loving woman would go missing without a trace. They reported her to the police as a missing person. The police immediately started interviewing Julia's close friends and family. They started to build up a picture of Julia's known movements on the day that she had last been seen. They spoke with Julia's friend who had been drinking with her earlier that day, and it was noted that she was last seen in the Bottle and Cork pub in Dudley. The police went to the pub and secured the CCTV footage. On the CCTV footage, they witnessed Julia drinking on her own, and later a man entered the bar. They saw her approaching this man and chatting with him. The CCTV footage rolled on for a few hours, and Julia was still drinking merrily with this man. At the end of the footage, they saw her leave the pub at 2 a.m. with the unknown man. After that, there were no further sightings of her. The police wasted no time releasing still images from the CCTV on as many mainstream, local and national media avenues as possible. In a matter of days, a member of the public contacted the police incident room and said that they knew who the man was. They said it was 30-year-old Nathan Maynard Ellis. On the 22nd of May, the day after Nathan's birthday, he was casually walking down the street near his grotty little flat with his boyfriend, David, when two police officers approached him. Both police officers were wearing body cams, and the entire interaction was captured on camera. The police officer stopped Nathan and he said, quote, "We're looking for a woman who's been missing for about 11 days. We've checked CCTV, and she was with someone who matches your description." End quote. Nathan feigned a mixture of concern and confusion, and he denied that he was the man that they were looking for. However, the police didn't believe him, and he was arrested immediately on suspicion of kidnapping Julia. The police didn't arrest David at this point, but he did speak with the police, and he provided a false alibi for Nathan. He said that he and Nathan had been in bed together all night on the date that Julia had gone missing, and that neither of them knew anything about Julia's disappearance. Of course, the police had CCTV images of Nathan having a very long conversation with Julia in the pub, and images of her leaving with him, so it was only a matter of time before David was arrested too, for both lying to the police and for being suspected of being an accomplice to Julia's kidnapping. The police sought the necessary search warrant paperwork, and they performed a detailed search in Nathan and David's creepy flat. They immediately realised that the carpet was really clean and new, which was vastly different from the rest of the poorly maintained furnishings. The police lifted up the new carpet, and they discovered a significant bloodstain on the floorboards underneath. It was looking increasingly likely that Julia's disappearance was going to go from a suspected kidnapping to a suspected murder. Back at the police station, during their separate interviews, Nathan and David provided the police with a pre-arranged and practically scripted version of events, which ultimately denied that they had any involvement in Julia's disappearance. But one of these filthy scumbags was not capable of maintaining their ridiculous story for too long. It was David who was the first to crack under the intense questioning, and he confirmed that the alibi that he had provided to the police was false. He said that he had actually gone to bed alone, and he had left Nathan in the living room. Even though it was evident that their stories were going to unravel, the police didn't believe that David knew nothing about Julia's presence in their flat, or that he wasn't involved in whatever had happened to her. However, David wouldn't divulge more, and Nathan wouldn't crack either. He stuck to his original story, and he wouldn't deviate one bit. He continuously stated that he didn't know Julia, he wasn't involved in her disappearance, and he didn't kill her. Nonetheless, the police pressed ahead with charges against him for suspected kidnapping and remanded him in custody while they gathered evidence for charges of suspected murder. But other than the evidence of the bloodstained floor, the new carpet and the CCTV, it was going too slow. Nathan was proving more psychotic and more stubborn to crack than they had originally expected. Then, 7 weeks after Julia had been killed, her body parts, including her severed head, hands and feet, were found. Three months after Julia's murder, on the 2nd of August 2020, Nathan caved and he admitted to killing her. Of course, given the amount of time that had passed since he'd lost his freedom, he was able to come up with a cock and bull story. He said that she approached him in the pub and she was flirting with him, but he thought that she was friendly, so he had a few drinks with her. At the end of the night, she asked Nathan if she could come back to his flat with him. He thought nothing of it and he agreed. However, when they got back to the flat, she made a sexual advance towards him and it angered him. He lashed out and he hit her on the head with a rolling pin. He went on to say that there were voices in his head telling him to attack her, and he pleaded a defense of diminished responsibility because he had Asperger's syndrome and chronic depressive disorder. In order to determine whether there was a case of diminished responsibility here, two different reports were obtained from two consultant forensic psychiatrists. These reports ruled out that Nathan was suffering from schizophrenia at the time of Julia's murder, and there was no evidence of him experiencing any psychotic episodes leading up to the killing. It was simply a case of him being bad, not mad. On the 6th of October 2020, 17 months after Julia had been murdered in Nathan and David's flat, the trial commenced. Interestingly, included amongst the various charges were additional charges of assault and rape of Nathan's ex-girlfriend when she was 15 years old. The police during their investigations had uncovered quite a bit more about Nathan when they were looking into his life. They contacted his ex-girlfriend, who was now 28 years old, and she was more than determined to press charges against him for what she had endured. Well done to that woman for being so brave to pursue justice against a despicable and disgusting prick like Nathan. At the trial, when it was Nathan's turn to take the stand, he tried everything he could to paint a different picture of himself. He told the court that he was bullied at school, but despite the horrible treatment he had received, he had turned his life around and gone on to achieve a distinction on a special effects, film and TV and theatre course. Prosecutor asked Nathan whether the horror films and terrifying books found in his flat had made him want to, quote, try to reenact any of it in real life, end quote. Nathan looked directly at the jurors and said, quote, no, I have looked at films to make costumes and masks and things, but not to act them out, end quote. The defense team tried to build a similar picture of Nathan and tried to elicit sympathy by saying that Nathan had contracted COVID-19 during the time that he had been in prison awaiting trial, and that he had been in and out of hospital 4 times for treatment and blood clots on his lungs. Interestingly, David, Nathan's seemingly mute boyfriend, did not take the stand at all. Nathan's mother's next-door neighbour confirmed that she had watched Nathan and David burning their clothes in the back garden and confirmed the date and time. Similarly, a member of the public confirmed that they had seen Nathan and David disposing of plastic bags near the canal and the wasteland near the primary school, the same locations that Julia's body had been found. This was confirmed by CCTV images from those locations too. During the trial, it was confirmed that even though Julia was a lesbian, she was known to be, quote, flirtatious with men while drunk, end quote. It was this flirtatiousness and friendliness that drove Julia to speak with Nathan at the bar and sealed her fate. After a month-long trial, on the 9th of November 2020, the jury retired to consider the evidence. Swiftly, they returned their verdicts. Both Nathan and David were found guilty on all charges. The following month, on the 21st of December 2020, they returned to the court for their sentencing. The judge made it quite clear that Nathan and David had acted together in murdering Julia, and then acted together in dismembering her body. Passing sentence, the judge said he was sure that both men had attacked Julia about the head with weapons, and then had engaged in a cool, calm, and thorough cover-up. The judge's statement was lengthy, but it was superb. Addressing both men, he said, quote, "You, Nathan Maynard Ellis, enter the Bottle and Cork Bar in Dudley. Julia Rawson, a complete stranger to you, had been there for some time. Fatally and tragically, she engaged you in conversation. At about 2 a.m. the following morning, you and she returned by taxi to the very small flat in Mission Drive, Tipton, which you shared with your partner David Leasley, and where he had remained when you went out that evening. However, I am sure that, at some point after you got into the taxi together, against the background of your established fantasies about killing someone, you formed the intent to kill her, and that killing was not decided by you on the spur of the moment in the flat. At some point in the early hours, and acting together, you murdered Julia Rawson, and then dismembered her body, all in the flat. Over the course of the next few days, you undertook a comprehensive attempt to cover up what you had done. Only you two know just what happened in the flat, but neither has told the truth. You were fascinated by films involving extreme violence and depravity, and notably those including violent killings, serial killers, necrophilia, and extending to cannibalism. You fantasized about killing someone, including by strangulation. You routinely carried a knife and would go out with a black hood and a thin rope, saying that you always had it with you if the right opportunity arose. I accept that Nathan was playing a leading role through all of this, but at all times, you, David, were giving him your unquestioning support. You were enthralled to Nathan from the time you first met him through the online dating site when you were 16, but pretending to be 18. And the evidence from your colleagues at the co-op provides telling support of your devotion to him thereafter. As I already indicated, I have concluded that Nathan instigated the attack on Julia Rawson, but that you immediately joined in. While accepting your involvement was unpremeditated, I am sure that in joining in you did so with an intent to kill, rather than to cause real serious bodily injury. In my judgment, you were thereupon doing Nathan's bidding and sharing his intent. In the same ready way, you then took part in the dismemberment and all of the other aspects of the cover-up. I accept that Nathan was playing the leading role through all of this, but at all times you were giving him your immediate and unquestioning support." End quote. At the end of his address, the judge ordered Nathan to serve at least 30 years and sentenced David to a minimum 19-year term. This episode has been too heavily focused on a pair of evil fuckers who deserved the hefty prison sentences that they received. But one person who didn't deserve what she received was Julia. I thought it would be appropriate to end the episode on the details of Julia's life that I could find in my research. These details came from quotes from people who knew and loved her. Her friend Debbie Maskell met Julia, or Ju as she became known, when they were 18 years old at Stafford Arts College. It was actually Debbie's friend, Elaine, who had introduced Debbie and Julia. Julia and Elaine had started their relationship when they met in art college. Debbie said fondly that her, Julia, and Elaine were inseparable, but it was Julia's endless energy and zest for life which made the three best friends have so much fun together. Debbie said, quote, "She was like a big kid. It was like she never grew up. Everything was just, wow, look at that. She was really full of life. She used to drag us out, make us do things. She was like an excited schoolgirl." End quote. Julia lived life to the full. She was a talented artist, who regularly met her friends with bits of paint spattered on her face. Other friends remembered Julia too. Whether she was socialising in the pubs of her hometown at Dudley, exhibiting her paintings, or managing her popular market stall, Julia always did it with a smile. She had no reservations about walking into a pub on her own because she knew everyone, and they all knew her from her market stall and the shop that she worked at. Julia was deeply interested in religion, and she used to attend monthly meetings to discuss her religious beliefs. Through these monthly meetings, she became good friends with another member of the group, a guy called Steve Gibbons. Steve said, quote, "If there was a word to describe her, it would be sunshine. You always knew where Julia was because she'd come up and put her head on your shoulder. She'd always greet people with a hug. She was just a very happy, tactile person." End quote. The saddest and most upsetting testimonies that I came across as part of my research came from Elaine, Julia's partner. She said, quote, "They killed a part of me too. Not a day goes by when I'm not thinking about her. She was my world. She took me out of myself. It's like that quote, I loved her in colours that don't exist. Not a day goes by without it hitting me that I'll never see her again, and it just knocks me for six." End quote. Besides socialising and painting, the other passion that Julia had was for music. One of her favourite bands was The Strokes, and when Julia heard that they were playing a gig in London, she bought tickets and surprised Elaine with them. Elaine and Julia spent months planning their trip to London, and they were really looking forward to the gig, but they never made it. The band played on the 25th of May 2019, 14 days after Julia went missing. Did you know that there are 195 countries in the world, and that out of those 195 countries, it's still illegal to be a gay man in 72 of them? Did you know it's still illegal to be a gay woman in 44 of them? And did you know that any same-sex activity in 11 of them could result in the death penalty? Utterly shameful in the year 2021. Why are LGBT plus people perceived to be immoral heathens in those countries? It's because those countries are governed by assholes. The people in charge have the power to change the perception of LGBT plus people in their countries, but they don't. Instead, they actively ask for LGBT plus people to be outed, to be imprisoned, to be brutalized and raped, or to be killed by their families. You might think there is very little you can do. There is. Research any LGBT plus equal rights charity and support their causes. Research the projects undertaken by the United Nations to support the advancement of LGBT plus equality and inclusion overseas. There's always something you can do to support the voices of the silenced. You've only got one life, so why not live it by being helpful and kind? Until next time.